The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 12th. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you on this beautiful Sunday morning. My name is Steve Matushak. I'm the program coordinator at Dharma Field. I say this every week now, but I think most of you know that. But it's great to see all of you, at least the all of you that I can see on the tiles on my computer screen right now. So my talk today is titled, Not So Hard. And the inspiration for this talk actually is just that it seems to us that Zen practice can be hard, that it can be really hard. And I should maybe really hard is too hard, but it does seem that it's hard. Our daily lives can pitch us about. I mean, there's just constantly stuff going on that makes it seem really difficult to take up this practice. I mean, those things that come toward us, they're just so, well, first of all, they're so numerous. They happen at every single moment we have something that's arising. And they distract us in so many different ways. I mean, they can cause great emotional turmoil for us. They can cause great joy for us. We get swept up in that. We can just get caught up in the stuff that's showing up. I thought this was just an old person's disease. When I go on the internet, if I'm looking something up on the internet, and then there's a little, icon that's telling me that I have messages someplace. And first thing I do is I go there. There's already like a dog chasing a squirrel. And I go after that icon and, you know, 5 minutes go by and then I'm done and I close my computer and then I go back to what I was doing. And I remember I was looking something up and I have to look again. And I was just talking to a young person, somebody who's 25 years old, and he told me he has to make a note for himself before he sits down at the computer so he can remember what it is he's going to the computer for. So we know that our daily lives can actually really pitch us about and distract us. And so, you know, how do you maintain a Zen practice in the middle of that? And on top of it, the circumstances today, so not only do we have our daily lives, but the circumstances in which our daily lives are unfolding, let's face it, if we're going to put a label on it, it's crazy, right? So coronavirus is going on right now, and all kinds of pressures coming because of that. I mean, existential pressures for some people, the pressures that social distancing puts on people. I mean, some people can't see their loved ones because of social distancing, or they have to do it in a very, you know, unusual way. And I don't know about those of you who maybe were excited about Zoom when it first started, but by about this point, excited is not exactly the word I would use to describe my interactions with Zoom. And so, you know, you kind of long to be near people, and I've started to see friends again, but you got to do that social distancing thing. And then there's that whole thing where you go, well, okay, I know we're no longer sitting 6 feet from us. That becomes the screen through which you're interacting with your family and your friends. So the coronavirus seems to, you know, be putting an extra wrinkle to our daily lives. We live in times where right now things seem very unsettled in a social political sense. And there are daily protests going on in this country and struggles for social justice. And those struggles right now seem to be very heated. There are sides that are locking down against it and other sides that are fighting for it. And so there's a great instability and in fact, that just shows up more generally in the political landscape. I'm still startled that, and I'm, you know, maybe I'm stirring a hornet's nest just by mentioning this, that wearing a face mask has become a political act. It just seems really strange to me. So there's a lot of energy around people's political beliefs right now, more so than I think I've ever experienced before. That I can remember. I'm old enough to have been around in 1968 when things were tumultuous, but I'm young enough that in 1968, I was really just watching the banana splits. I wasn't paying attention to what was going on in the political scene. But so all of these things, you know, the circumstances in which our daily lives show up and just the nature of our daily lives, it just, it makes it seem like Zen practice is really difficult, if not impossible to do. And then you want to put a cherry on top of that dessert. We get teachings that tell us how difficult it is. Frequently, Dogen tells us how difficult this is. And in his, for example, in his text, Guidelines for Studying the Way, he says this. He says, students who would like to study the way must not wish for easy practice. If you seek easy practice, you will for certain never reach the ground of truth or dig down to the place of treasure. Even teachers of old who had great capacity said that practice is difficult. You should know that the Buddha way is vast and profound. So you read something like that or you hear something like that and you go, even teachers of old who had great capacity said that practice is difficult. I'm nobody. How is this not going to be difficult for me? Right? So you hear that and Zen practice sounds very difficult. And there's a sense in what Dogen's saying that I think we already have anyhow, that if you seek easy practice, you'll never reach the ground of truth or dig down to the place of treasure. We know that kind of makes sense. If it's easy, what kind of work are you doing? What is actually taking place there? Often if something is easy, something has been short-circuited. There's been a short shortcut that's gone on, or things are really just staying the same, right? That's the easy way to do it, is to really not make any kind of change at all. So in a way, it sort of makes sense to us. And in traditional learning, we know that traditional learning is not easy. I remember when I was first learning how to teach, I used to tell my students, learning hurts. They did not like to hear that. But, you know, if you think about what learning is, if you're really learning, you're encountering something new. You're in unfamiliar territory. Something is changing for you. The way that you understand is changing. And the way that change frequently registers for us isn't discomfort. You know, it's not that learning has to hurt, but it can show up that way. And if it does show up that way, you're probably encountering something new. So we do, I think, intuitively understand that anything that's really worthwhile is probably not easy. But I think that begs the question of what is hard? In other words, what do we mean by hard? What do we mean when we say that Zen practice is hard or Zen practice is difficult? What is Dogen talking about when he says that? In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shinryu Suzuki says, people say that practicing Zen is difficult, but there is a misunderstanding as to why. It is not difficult because it is hard to sit in a cross-legged position or to attain enlightenment. It is difficult because it is hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. All right, so let's sort of look at what Suzuki is talking about here. He says, it is not difficult because it is hard to sit in a cross-legged position. And that's level one. And for some people, sitting in a cross-legged position is difficult. I mean, some people can't even get in that posture. So it can be a difficult thing. For me, I can't even believe it when I say this, but it took me years to find a posture in the cross-legged position. Years. Or it didn't cause me great discomfort. I can't believe I let it go on that long. It just never dawned on me to ask my teacher how I should be sitting. But, you know, it can be difficult. But Suzuki's saying, well, that's not really what's difficult, to sit in the cross-legged position. You just sit. You know, it's hurting. You just adjust your position. The one that's perhaps more surprising to people might be Suzuki says, it's not difficult to attain enlightenment. That's the one where people are like, what? It's not difficult to attain enlightenment. That seems to be the big prize, isn't it? That's the Cracker Jack prize. That's the prize inside the Cracker Jack box. And I never seem to be able to find it. So you think you always, I don't know if you were a kid and you'd look inside the box I don't really like Cracker Jacks that much, but I like the prizes a lot. So the first thing I would do is open the box up and then start looking for the prize. And you couldn't find it. And you go, oh, I got a dud box that didn't have a prize in it, right? And enlightenment is a little bit like that, where it seems to always be eluding us. And Suzuki's saying, that's not what's difficult about Zen practice. What he says is difficult, I think, is probably hard for us to, I don't want to say hear, but to know what he's talking about. He says it is difficult because it is hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. And now you hear that word pure and you go, okay, this is exactly where it's difficult. You can recognize it. If you're going to allow Suzuki the fact that attaining enlightenment is not difficult. And by the way, we experience enlightenment at every moment. And you know, waking up to a tasting enlightenment that comes, if you welcome it in, it comes at any moment, you know, and it does. We know it. We know what this tastes like. When I started sitting meditation and I started to taste it, I'd say, oh, that's what I was tasting when I was 3 years old or 2 years old. Now I have memories that go back a little bit farther than I think they're supposed to. So who knows if they're imagined, but that taste of enlightenment was right there. But it's hard to keep your mind pure. Now that we can understand, purity seems to bring a whole heavy baggage with it. And what does it mean to keep your mind pure? What does that mean? What is he talking about? Well, perhaps we've encountered these teachings enough to know that we hear about a mind that has no preferences. So we think keeping our mind pure is to have no preferences or desires. Remember the second bodhisattva vow, to be released from all desires. So we might think, oh, okay, so pure mind is a mind that has no preferences or no desires. What kind of a mind is that? Some people have asked, and I think reasonably so, who wants a mind like that, that has absolutely no preferences to it or no desires? But we might think that's what's being asked of us. How do you do that? How do you attain that? Or maybe we've heard that a pure mind, or that Buddhist practice actually has no judgment, no preferences, no desires, no judgment. And I have heard people say, you know, just if you think, well, I'm not sure that I quite think that that's, you know, what people think about Buddhist practice, but I've heard people say, and I would ask you to ask yourself if you've said something on the order of, well, I know I'm not supposed to judge people, but boy, that X sure is a jerk. I don't care what Buddha says. That's the truth of the matter, right? So no judging, and that's really difficult for us to do. And then we think, well, in some cases, you have to judge. You just have to come down because this is wrong, and this needs to stop. And I'm judging it in that way, and that's the way that it needs to go. And I can't imagine that Buddhism is telling me that that's not true, that this is not right. And there you are, right? So you start to see how the practice becomes difficult just from, well, what is that pure mind? How about pure practice? The other thing that Suzuki points out, and that is the practice. Maybe we go, oh, pure practice. I know what that is. That's where I practice, but I don't have any goals. No goals whatsoever. And this, again, becomes very baffling for people, and it makes Zen practice sound impossible, because how are you supposed to do something if you don't have some kind of goal in mind? This just doesn't make any sense to us. In fact, again, I will often hear people talk about their meditation practice, and they go, you know, I really think that meditation practice helps me be more relaxed in my life. I know it's not supposed to have any goals, but you know, you hear this thing about what it is that meditation practice is supposed to and not supposed to have in it. And the stuff that it's not supposed to have sounds almost impossible. No goals, no preferences, no desires, no judging. Whew, I mean, wow, man. No wonder why it sounds so difficult. But I think that all of this is pointing to, what do we even mean by Zen practice? What is it that we're talking about when we're talking about this thing that's hard, this thing that's difficult? What is Zen practice? What is all that stuff I was just talking about before, about not having desires, not having preferences, not judging, not having any goals. What is Zen practice? And, you know, that's a great question. I think just on an immediate level, I think to some people that may be sitting cross-legged on a cushion is what Zen practice means. Maybe we don't have time in our schedules to sit cross-legged on a cushion. Or maybe the times that our Zen center, the temple we go to, when they sit, it doesn't work for the times that we can sit, so we just can't quite work it into our schedules. And so maybe Zen practice seems difficult that way. But if you take up these teachings, if you've heard teachers talk about this, you know that Zen practice is not limited to sitting cross-legged on a cushion. And so then we say, well, what is it that seems so difficult to us? And again, we probably have heard terms like it's about being mindful. It's about coming back to here and now. So being mindful, what is being mindful? Mindfulness is one of those terms that now is being used so often by so many different people in so many different kind of contexts that what mindfulness even means is a little hard to figure out. And I will say that in a way it's because mindfulness is an activity that you can't really encapsulate. You know, it's an activity that you do it. So being able to talk about it is kind of difficult. But we might have some ideas about what being mindful is, because we've heard teachers say, well, it's paying attention to what's taking place right now. And again, when we think about the difficulty of this practice, what we're talking about is Zen practice is hard. Well, heck, paying attention is easier said than done. I don't know about you, but usually I'm paying attention after I've already broken something or after I've already spilled the milk or stepped into something or said something I shouldn't have said. So paying attention, that kind of being mindful, that seems easier said than done. And even more so, it has this weird, I don't want to say it's a dimension to being mindful, but it's a way that we might understand it, especially when we first take up the practice, which is that it sounds like we're kind of dividing ourselves a little bit, that I have to be outside of everything that I'm doing right now to pay attention to it. I need to be watching and being mindful of everything that I'm doing and saying. And it creates this feeling, at least I know I did when I was first taking this up, of kind of a split or an alienation that's occurring. And that doesn't even sound very desirable. And you know from hearing the teachings that this is not about fracturing the world up. So that kind of understanding, you kind of have a sense that that's probably not what the teachers are pointing to. So what does that pay attention? Well, come back to here and now. Well, come back to here and now. Sometimes coming back to here and now is hard to do. Here and now is not always a comfortable place to be. It can be a painful place to be. And so coming back here, again, easier said than done. And so we can go on and on and on with this and start to see the difficulty of what's going on, because it's hard for us to imagine what practice is without imagining what practice is. So it's hard to imagine what practice is without imagining what practice is. So we start to imagine, we start to get ideas about what Zen practice is. And I'm going to pursue that now for pretty much the rest of my talk, is about how those ideas that we have about what this practice is what makes it so hard. And we can see that that's a difficulty that we have. So that what's difficult about Zen practice isn't that we're expected to be saints, even though, if you think of the Bodhisattva vows, the first one is to save all sentient beings. Whew. Number two is be released from all desires. And there are other teachings, the teachings of the paramitas, of generosity and home leaving. And, you know, we're not expected to be saints. That's not why this practice is difficult. It's because we have ideas about those about what practice is, and we cling to those ideas. Now, I'm not saying don't have ideas about what practice is, especially when you take this practice up. Well, what? It just seems impossible to even encounter this practice without having some ideas about what it is, without having some perhaps ideas about what we're going to get from it. The difficulty we have is that we cling to those ideas and we don't even know we're clinging to them. That's why you'll hear people say something like, well, I know I'm not supposed to do this when I meditate. And meditation really isn't about supposed to or not supposed to, or should or shouldn't. That's really not what's occurring in mindfulness meditation. That's not what's occurring in Zazen. But we hang on to those. So we cling to our ideas about what practice is. And so Dogen, who told us that practice was difficult, he also tells us this. This is from the Shobogen Zazui Monkey, which is a collection of Dharma talks that Dogen gave to his monks. And Dogen was a Zen teacher from the 13th century of Japan. And this is actually a section and a talk that Steve Hagen has referred to on a number of occasions. It's section 4, talk 3. And Dogen says, students of the way, the reason you do not attain enlightenment is because you hold on to your old views. Without knowing who taught you, you think that mind, and he's got that in quotation marks, that mind is the function of your brain, thought, and discrimination. When I tell you that mind is grass and trees, you do not believe it. When you talk about the Buddha, you think the Buddha must have various physical characteristics and a radiant halo. If I say that Buddha is broken tiles and pebbles, you show astonishment. The views you cling to are neither what has been transmitted to you from your father nor what you were taught by your mother. You have believed them for no particular reason. They are the result of having listened for a long time to what people have said. Therefore, since it is the definite word of the Buddhas and patriarchs, when it is said that mind is grass, you should understand that mind is grass and trees, I'm sorry. You should understand that grass and trees are mind. And if you are told that Buddha is tiles and pebbles, you should believe that tiles and pebbles are Buddha. Thus, if you reform your attachment, you'll be able to attain the way. So if we look again at what Dogen is pointing out to us, the reason you do not attain enlightenment is you hold on to your own views. And those views are multifold in this little passage. He says, you think that mind is the function of your brain. That is a real common way that people think of mind. That's not the mind that teachers of the awakened are pointing to when they speak of mind. They're talking of reality. In fact, if we think about people thinking and they point to their brain. I remember having a moment when I was walking into a classroom when I suddenly wondered why we do that. It's because we've been told that there's this activity that's going on in our brain that is consciousness. And yet, if you really look at the moment, you realize that that's just the way that we have of talking about what it is that's taking place. So he says, you think that mind is a function of your brain, thought and discrimination. When I tell you that mind is grass and trees, you do not believe it. So then we also have grass and trees. And grass and trees are separate from mind. And we think of, well, how is mind showing up for us? Well, as this experience. So grass and trees become separated from this experience. Grass and trees become something that the way we think of it is I experience it. Rather than just the experience of grass and trees is showing up, we separate it out. We have mind and grass and trees. You think Buddha must have various physical characteristics and a radiant halo. Perhaps we don't quite think of Buddha that way much anymore. I don't know. Before I took up Buddhism, I'm embarrassed to say that I thought Buddha was the fat Chinese guy that you'd see at Chinese restaurants. I thought that was Buddha. I was actually surprised when I found out he was Indian. I was like 40 some years old. And I went, Buddha was Indian? Oh, I had no idea. I thought he was that Chinese guy, you know? So we might have ideas about what Buddha is in this particular historical figure. They might even be completely wrong ideas about what Buddha is. And Dogen goes on to say, though, if I say Buddha is broken tiles and pebbles, you show astonishment. So even if we don't think of Buddha as being that historical figure, Buddha means awakened one. And there's in that, again, what I was talking about earlier, that difficulty, that crackerjack prize, there's enlightenment. And so Buddha is one who's awake. Buddha is someone who's separate from the rest of us because they're awake. So that idea we have of Buddha becomes separate from, again, experience. And Buddha becomes separate from tiles and pebbles. And when Dogen says Buddha is broken tiles and pebbles, you show astonishment because you're clinging to these ideas that you have about what mind is, what grass and trees are, what tiles and pebbles are, what Buddha is. Dogen says you believe them for no particular reason. They're the result of having listened for a long time to what people have said. So we get these notions. These are enculturated notions that we have, shared truths that we have about reality. Now, he says you don't learn it from your mother and father. Well, some of it you do, some of it you don't. I remember asking my parents all kinds of things when I was a little kid. What's that? What's that? What's that? You're around little kids, you know they'll do that. Oh, what's that? And what's really great is when they get to that point where you cannot answer their questions anymore, and then you just go, oh, shut up. But yeah, we are taught this way of understanding the world in all kinds of ways. I mean, it's not just from people. Sometimes it's just we test things out, and then we go, okay, this is what's going on. Somebody told me an interesting story about a baby, what a baby was seeing. And a baby was lying on, we'll say, her back, and she moved her leg. And when she moved her leg, the curtain moved. And so she noticed that the curtain had moved, and she moved her leg again. She looked up at the curtain, you know, thinking that the curtain. So we learn as we go through, we get ideas about how the world is showing up. The baby thought that she was making the curtain move with her leg, until she tried it out a few more times, and then it got boring because it clearly was not what was happening, right? So we get ideas both from what we hear and what we kind of test out, and then we get these ideas, and that's the way that we understand reality. So Zen practice is difficult because Zen practice is now something, and it's something that's different or separate from what's showing up right here. It's something that we put on top of that. It's separating grass and trees and mind. It's separating Buddha and pebbles and tiles. And so then we ask ourselves, well, how do I stop distinguishing them? How do I stop? What is Zen practice if I don't understand it as something that's separate? How? And I would say, right there, at least just see what's going on right there. As you ask, how do I do this? See? So we'll be told, just come back to here and now. Come back to what's taking place right now, what's unfolding right now. And we'll say, well, how do I do that? I'll just come back to what's now, what's taking place here and now. You don't need to even tell yourself, oh, I need to come back to what's taking place here and now. And again, this can be kind of a common thing we do as we're drifting off. And that, you go, oh, I just lost in thought. I mean, I don't know if people do that. I kind of would do that. I'm lost in thought again. You know, it happens so often. It'd be like, you know, the teaching you have of at the beginning of meditation practice, if you find that you have problems, just sort of staying with the moment is to count your breath. And I was always astonished how quickly I would lose track of what number I was on. Or I'd be, you know, you count up to 10 and then you start over again. I'd be like, 32, 33. Wait a minute. What's going on? Okay. One, two, and I would do all of that, right? And so come back to the present moment right now. Okay, I come back now. Hi. So we either ask ourselves, how do we stop distinguishing? And we've been told, just come back to the present moment. And then we ask ourselves, well, how do I do that? And just notice when you're doing that. Notice when you're making something out of this. Practice is hard because we make it hard. I know I've been saying that now. And it sounds like a truism too, because I think we do understand that we make things difficult for ourselves, that a lot of our difficulties come from the way that we approach what we're doing. I gave instructions to my father-in-law once. We were doing some project at the cabin and I was in charge of some tasks. They rarely give me things to do there, and I think it's for this reason. So I was in charge of this project, and then my father-in-law came over and said, okay, we're going to do this, and I was explaining to him how to do it, and he was trying to follow my instructions, and my instructions were designed such that we would not accidentally injure ourselves or accidentally break what we were working on. So it was sort of built into what we were doing, was to avoid doing those things. And he's getting this look on his face like, and he's trying to do it. And finally, he realizes how complicated my instructions are. And he just goes, oh, for God's sake. And he just did the thing. And he did it in far less time than it was taking me to explain it to him, because I made it difficult. And like I said, we are aware of the fact that we have a tendency to do this. So it sounds like that truism. But I would say Zen practice too is not hard, because we practice Zen with a light touch rather than a hard touch. So rather, when we come back to now, to just what's taking place right now, to say, I'm coming back to what's taking place right now, or we make some kind of concerted effort, like, okay, I'm lost right now, I'm coming back. To do that, that's too hard. Zen practice is a light touch. How do we stop separating grass and trees from mind? Just this. Just this. You don't have to do any more than that. Just this, just this, this experience. In this experience, we make something out of it though. So if we taste awakening, if just this, we actually taste what's showing up, we want to grab hold of it and make something of it. Oh, well, that was it. Whatever label you put on it, Kensho. I just had a Kensho experience. I just had an enlightenment experience. And you know, this is not an uncommon thing to have an experience and go, okay, I just had this experience. What I used to do years before I took up this practice, if I had some kind of experience that was startling, I would memorize it and then I would tell everybody I knew about it, because I'm a storyteller. So I would just like tell everybody. I knew, to the point, I remember I had one friend, I only saw him like once every couple weeks. So he was there at the beginning of my storytelling cycle and he was there at the end of my storytelling cycle. And I'd start telling him, I go, okay, so there was this time where I was in the shower, and then he goes, is this where the shower wall kind of disappeared and you realized that it wasn't really there? And it's like, oh, you heard this one already? So I would make something of an experience, and then I would turn it into a story, and then I would tell everybody the story. Most people don't quite go that hard. You just make something out of the experience, and then you say, oh, I want that to happen. This must be the thing. This is the crackerjack prize. So I'm going to make that happen again. And then we've got difficulties again. We can make too much of it. And I certainly did that in my practice. Probably my favorite example of that is the time I just noticed something when I was sitting in a meditation retreat, and I was so excited. We have these meetings with the teacher. They're called Dokusan, just a one-to-one meeting with the teacher. And I remember I got so excited that as soon as the meditation period was over, I ran out into the room where you sign up for meetings with the teacher. And I signed up so I could share with Steve the wonderful insight that I had sitting on my cushion. And it was right at the end of the day. So there were no more Dokusans. And I remember I went to sleep and I woke up the next morning and I saw my name on that sign up sheet. And I just went, oh no, I really don't have it. I shouldn't be saying anything at all. What I experienced was absolutely nothing. And that's pretty much what I share with Steve. And he reminded me, he said, it's light touch, not so hard. When you have those experiences, not so hard. Light touch, just let it show up. Just let whatever it is show up. Reality itself is not difficult. This is pointed out to us in Trusting the Heart Mind, Sengsan's great poem. It opens, the great way is not difficult. There is nothing it prefers. Only when you neither love nor hate does it appear clearly without disguise. A hair's breadth of difference and heaven and earth are set apart. The great way is not difficult. This is reality. There's nothing it prefers. And really think about that. Reality has no preferences. And I think sometimes for people that can be chilling. If you've gone through your life perhaps thinking that things are going your way for a reason. Maybe you've been a good boy. This is your reward. Whatever it is, if this is coming about for a reason, to think that reality actually has no preference, good boys or bad boys, right? That it has no preference. Reality has no preference. And yet there's something very freeing about that if you can really see that. Reality is just this, right? It doesn't have any preference. Then you hear that only when you neither love nor hate does it appear clearly. And you go, that's the thing I'm talking about. It's impossible. How do you not love or hate? But it's not. You've got an idea again. You've got an idea of what that means. Just let that go. Be light in the touch of that. Because that neither love nor hate, it's just letting it, just whatever it is, be this without making it anything of it. But if we make something of it, if there's love or hate in that usual sense that we have, then, as Sengsan points out, heaven and earth are set apart. For us, that's the way it seems to be. Then there's something else, perhaps heaven, that peaceful place, that equanimity, whatever it is that we're thinking it is, it's apart from us. It's something that we need to get rather than just see that's right here. And it's right here in the non-preferential nature of what's showing up. If I can go back to a word that Suzuki had used earlier, the purity of what's showing up. It's not pure because it's like, you know, I don't know. I was going to say not stained, but you'll hear teachings that say reality does not get stained. But I just mean like, I've got like a scribbled sheet of paper here, right? Kind of stained and messed up. It's a grocery list. I got it sitting right here by my computer, and that's pure. That's purely that, you know? Or right now, I do like to go on walks. It's something I appreciate. A lot of the baby geese have grown up. So when I go out into the parks, there's a lot of bombs that I have to walk around. That's nature purely showing up as that. That's purity of reality, just as it is, just that. And even as to think of it, to burden it with these notions of goose dung or whatever it is you're going to burden it with, even that is taking it too far, which is not to say that the goose poop is not showing up. But it's how do you live that? How do you live that experience? So I say this and you can hear, you say the great way is not difficult. You can hear that the great way is probably not easy either. And actually Sengsan goes on to tell us that later in Trusting Heart Mind. He says the great way is all embracing. I mean, it's just totality. It's neither easy nor difficult. It's neither easy nor difficult. It's just this. It's what you see, hear, whatever experience right now. It's just this. There's no need to label. Now, no need to label doesn't mean you blank your mind out. See? How do I do this? What do I imagine this is? And we're back to that again. I need to blank my mind out. No. Just let this show up the way that it always shows up. when I sit meditation at home, which is where I have been sitting meditation every day now for the last 3.5 months, basically. But when I do that, and I sit in my study and I face a closet door, the closet door is there, but when I sit, it's not my closet door, but it's not my closet door. And that, again, it sounds so complicated and difficult, but it only is if you do something with that. If you just let the experience of seeing closet door just arise, and it's not even has those terms on it. You don't have to say, I'm seeing closet door arise. If that's just arising with the bird song and the breeze that's blowing through the windows, when that's just arising and no labels on it, that's just letting it as it is, which isn't to mean there's not a closet door and that I don't see a closet door, but I'm not stuck there. I don't have to do anything. And I don't have to go, okay, that's not a closet door, but it really is a closet. I don't have to do anything. I just let the experience arise. You don't have to do anything. Now, we have to do something. So what does it mean when we have to do something? And by that, I mean, no matter, this is the way our reality shows up. You have to act. You have to act, even if acting is not, you think, well, my actions, I'm not going to do anything. Even that is an action. So you have to do something. What does it mean then not to do anything? And that's a good question. How, again, do we not imagine what that means? And all of this is showing us what Dogen is pointing to us in his teaching, what it is that that students of the way, what is their difficulty, right? He says, you hold on to your old views. And that's what we do. They're so tenacious. And those ideas that he's talking about, they're not just the way we think of ideas. It's the whole way we put together experience. It's the whole way we put that together. We cling to that. We have ideas about it. And when we do that, so again, like I said, when experience is seeing closet door, it's just seeing closet door. You could argue closet door, you know, is some kind of idea. Obviously, that is absolutely true. You don't have to do anything with it. You don't have to cling to it. You don't have to be limited by the ideas that you have. You don't have to dwell in them as they show up, as glass of water and me drinking glass of water shows up. Usually we get narrowed into that. And this has got a reality to it that we don't even need to ascribe. We don't even need to do any work. Like, well, this isn't really the, you know, all that. Well, it's a glass of water, but it's not a glass of water. Just experience drinking a glass of water. That's the difficulty, again, is that we cling to ideas. We make something out of experience. And then Zen practice is hard. Too hard a touch. Remember, this is light touch. Just be here. And that can be very difficult when it's just light touch. When to actually do what we normally do is too hard. So those are the comments I wanted to make this morning about Zen practice and Zen practice being hard. So I'd like to invite any questions or comments people might have. Now, it looks like I have a chat question here and from Shirley. And after that, Mike, I do see your hand is raised. Let's see if I can make sense of this, Shirley. No judgment. Could you tease out how that relates to the impulse to judge when crossing paths with people that don't social distance? Oops. that don't social distance, wear masks. Judgment seems to come easily and flows to they don't value the health of others, community, above personal preferences. And that's a great question. Again, when we were thinking about no judgment, this is not that we don't judge. We judge. This is what we do. But now what do you do? So I just saw a video recently, and I'm guessing a lot of you did because it seemed to be one of those things that's circulating right now. And somebody took their cell phone out. There was a guy, and he didn't have a mask on, and they started filming him because he didn't have a mask on. And if you saw, the guy said something really strange. He said something like, "You are threatening me." That was the first thing he said, which was an interesting thing to say. He said, "You're threatening." He didn't say it. He yelled it. "You're threatening me. You're threatening me." And then he just went off into this big time. And I can't tell you what the impulse was for that, for the person to record. But I would just ask, again, I can't judge that action, but I could say, if you were going to do that, why? You know, what is it? In what, to what degree are you taking this up? So judgment arises, but the real question to ask is how you act out of that, how you see that judgment. And maybe I can make this a little more clearly and say, a lot of times with our judgments, we think that our judgments are right. Right? So you have person doesn't have their face mask on, they don't value the health of others, the community, above personal preferences. And yet I can't talk any more about this than to say that I know somebody who has difficulties wearing masks because she says that she gets migraine headaches when she wears masks, really intense headaches. So then I look at they don't value the health of others, and I don't know. But see, now that judgment has a harshness. It has like really hard edges to it that are making assumptions. They're making assumptions about the other person. They're making assumptions about the right thing to do in a situation or not to do in a situation. I really don't know. And that's where judgment comes in. I don't know if this is helpful at all, Shirley, but judgments do arise. But are your judgments these solid things that you have no doubt about what it is that you think, you know, all the valuations that come with it? Or can you see that that judgment is, say, limited, that it's coming from an understanding that you have? And granted, this is how we move about in the world. We move about from limited understandings. That's how we make judgments. That's where our judgments come from. That's what we want to always remember, that our judgments are coming from a limited way of looking. They always do. So we don't not make judgments, but we don't cling to those judgments. They don't have that kind of realness to them. They don't have that kind of, there's no way out. This is the way that it is. And I'll say right now, I think it's very easy to take one's judgments as being true, in a capital T kind of, just very easy to do that, especially if those judgments have been verified by others. So that's what Dogen was talking about. We learn from others. I wrote a post recently about, policing and problems in policing and problems in policing. And, you know, as I was writing it, I realized I was writing it, and then I watched a television show called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, a very funny show, I think. And John Oliver was saying everything that I was saying in my blog post. And I just went, yep, you know, I think I've got this great wisdom. And of course, I joked. I just said, well, it could be that two great minds think alike, you know. But in reality, we were undoubtedly reading and listening to the same stuff. And so our ideas get corroborated. And then in that corroboration, they take a reality. This is the way it really is. This is the way it should be. should be. Even when we think we don't think that, we will act out of that. Does that help, Shirley? At least to a degree? Yeah, good. Thank you. I didn't quite expect my answer to be so long there, so I'm sorry if that was a bit long-winded. Mike, it looks like you have a question. Go ahead and unmute yourself.
Okay. You know, it's one thing not to have ideas about practice, but sometimes I have a sense of, you know, the present moment is unpleasant. It's painful. It hurts. And this is beyond any ideas of what I might have about it. You know, it hurts. So I don't know. To say that maybe I'm answering my own question. But to say that I should have no judgment, I mean, who, you know, when reality shows up in an unpleasant or painful way, I don't know, for me to say that I would not wish it to go away or be otherwise, it seems like I would almost have to be a rock to have that kind of, and I think you touched on this, what I even want to. So, I mean, I guess my question is, for some time, just to say that whatever shows up, okay, it shows up, and if it's painful, it's painful, and, you know, I mean, it just seems to be too much to bear. So.
Well, you know, there's a couple things in there. One, just notice, I would just invite you to notice when you say should or shouldn't.
Yeah.
When you say it's supposed to be like this or it's not supposed to be. So that's right. Just one thing I'd invite you to do, because once you start to do that, you're talking about the kind of preferences at same time.
Yeah.
And really that reality doesn't have. Our reality has no sense about the way things should be or should be.
Right. I understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. So just I'm just inviting you to pay attention to that, because it came up a lot in your question and comment. And it's something that just comes up naturally for us. We do think there are, you know, ways that things should be and shouldn't be. And there are things we like and don't like. And most of, you know, I would say most of us don't like pain. Some people like pain and maybe in some very, very prescribed kinds of ways. But look again at that. I don't want to be here because it's hurtful.
Right.
You know, and then that's another thing just to notice. So now you're back to the preference again. So it's not about not having preference, but it's really to see, in a way, to help us to see that preference is overriding almost any other thing. So what we want to do is we imagine then a reality that we would prefer to have at this particular moment. And so the reality that's showing up, in a way, gets shortchanged. Even if it's a painful reality, I do remember, I think you asked a similar question to Warren Lang, and I thought his response was so great. You know, he just said, well, you know, yeah, that can be hard, you know, when something is showing up and it's very painful or difficult for us. But our practice is not to turn away from that pain. Right. Our practice is to face pain and to deal with it, you know, to actually work with, to take care of what's showing up, which is, it seems like, you know, oh, well, then the way I want to take care of this pain is to get rid of the pain. But it's just to take care of it, whatever that means. So yeah, we're sort of asking, well, how do I do this? How do I do this? What's the thing I do? Which you weren't asking, but somebody might ask.
Yeah, I would ask that now.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, again, that's our tendency. How do I do this? I think I've said in the past that every once in a while when I'm in the middle of my life, I go, I wish I had an instructor's manual. I wish I had somebody who would tell me what it is I should do right now, because I have no idea, right? And that, in a way, that's the thrill of life, to be honest, is that you do have to pay attention and step forward into it. We're learning constantly if we're paying attention. And like I said, learning hurts. It doesn't have to, but it can.
Yeah, and And it's like you said in your recent class too, you know, a Zen practice is about stepping forward into life in each moment.
Yeah.
Just stepping forward. But not easy.
Yeah.
Especially
again, it's not easy because in a way it's not easy because even stepping forward into life, you know, I talk about that light touch, even that, to be honest, maybe not light enough.
Yeah.
This really, it's so light, the touch of just being here, just being present.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't require anything else. It's just this.
And we have no choice but to be present anyway, because we're already here.
That's absolutely right.
Yep. Yeah, maybe that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Or it's like, you know, I had my, this week's update, I talked about a short story that I read. That was so neat when I got to the end of that short story, because it was about this rock and roll band and they were playing a song and everybody started dancing to the song. First it was everybody at the dance, and then it was everybody at the hotel where the dance is held, and then it was everybody in the town, and then it was everybody throughout all of time, because once you show up, you're in the dance. And then there are a few people in that story who think they're outside the dance. And they take their own lives. You know, they see themselves as being outside of the dance, and they're in the dance. To be here, to show up, is to be in the dance. Is to be here, it's to be, you know, this.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. One more minute here. Jim, you got a question? Go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hey, hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Greetings from Los Angeles. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
The banana splits reference was, I hadn't thought of that one for a long time. my question is, and you touched on this a bit, but pure mind, everything being pure. And if it's all this, and even what Mike alluded to, the arising of whatever emotions coming up is also this, how can anything be impure? And it's just this, and even our frustration is this, so how is anything wrong or out of place? What, you know, where do we go when we, so is it just the judging? Like, is it just the, as everything arises, just kind of accepting?
Yeah, well, those are great questions. And I would say the one, problem isn't the right word, but the one thing about accepting is that acceptance seems to have built into it that there's something that's showing up that we have to accept. There's like a begrudging quality to it. It doesn't necessarily have to have that dimension. You might not have made that, but that's my only thing about accepting what's showing up. But otherwise it is accepting in that it's just sort of accepting, like opening the door up, you know, and letting whatever it is show up, be, you know, to show up. Mm-hmm. And so how can anything be impure or wrong? That's good question. How can it be? So we go through our lives figuring out what's impure and what's wrong and what's out of place. And yet, just as you said, how can it be? How can it be? So what is showing up then if something seems to be appearing to us that's wrong or impure? What is it that's actually showing up there? And again, that's the invitation of our practice, is to notice that, to see what it is that's showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because, you know, reality itself can't be impure.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.